Well, hello again and welcome to another of our Berwick Bites. This time joining me, I'm honoured to be joined by Tom Cogan. Tom is probably the dean of labour relations academics in the United States. He's the George Maverick Bunker Professor of Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, where he's been a faculty member since the 1980s. Tom has probably written somewhere between 12, 13, 14 books and contributed chapters to innumerable others, and it's impossible to count the number of academic papers and other papers and policy papers he's written over the years. More recently, Tom has been concerned about the need to renew the social contract in America and has been also thinking about whether or not the United States is ripe for new forms of employee representation beyond that provided for under the National Labor Relations Act. Tom, welcome. And as I said to you a couple of moments ago, great to see you in the great outdoors there. We wish we could be with you, but we obviously can't.
Great to be with you, Tom. And I wish I was actually where this picture is taken. Later today, I will be.
Yeah, that's the world we live in. That's the world we live in. So, Tom, let me just put it to you straight up. Right? The existing American labor relations system was legislated for in the 1930s with the National Labor Relations Act. It was then perfected after the Second World War in the late 1940s and into the 1950s and produced, as you and many others have written, produced the American middle classes. I'm an outsider. Looking in from the outside, the American system seems to me to be broken and broken beyond repair. Do you see it the same way?
Well, Tom, first we should be clear that we have an enormous debt of gratitude to the framers of that National Labor Relations Act and the laws of the 1930s, because they did serve such an important economic and social and political function of building our middle class and supporting workers' rights to have a voice. But it's totally broken now. It's outmoded. It doesn't protect workers' rights to organize anymore under the procedures built into the Act. It's too restrictive in the forms of representation, and it needs fundamental updating and reform and renewal.
What broke it?
It got broken because the world of work has changed. The workforce is more diverse than it was when we had manufacturing workers, production workers, the dominant part of the labor force in the post-1930s through the 40s as manufacturing grew. And now we have professional workers, we have more women workers, we have more racial minorities who are part of the workforce. That's one piece. But the biggest determinant is that management has become much, much more sophisticated in resisting unions and in keeping workers from exercising their rights under the law. And that's the dominant reason why unions can't organize under these procedures. And so we need to address both the power imbalance, but also the fact that the workforce needs a variety of different mechanisms to restore their voice at work.
See, I often hear this argument, Tom, that American management, and I'll come back to that, sort of the position of American management in a couple of moments, but I often hear this argument that American management are deeply hostile to unions and have become very sophisticated in developing techniques to prevent unionization. But if I look across Western Europe, which is where I live, you know, union density has been on the slide as well over the last 20 odd years. And you don't have the management hostility to unionization that you have in the States. It's not the simple fact that you mentioned the changing nature of the workforce. It's that these new workers simply do not want to join unions.
Well, I think we have to get the facts put in kind of priority order. There's no question that American managers, by and large, are more opposed to unions historically and currently than in other parts of the world, particularly in Western Europe. Why that's the case is a big debate among historians and so on, but the fundamental truth is that management fought unions prior to the passage of the labor law in the 1930s. They had the police out there. They had private investigators and espionage and all of those efforts to keep unions out. The law then tempered those efforts to resist, strengthened workers' rights, and for a while, management recognized that workers and unions were getting powerful enough that they couldn't resist in those ways, and they had to accommodate.
Before you go on, let me ask you a question. You know, you say this is the subject of a big debate. What's your take? What's your take on why American managers are so hostile to unions?
There's a deep culture of elevating private property in the United States to a status that gives its rights to individual entrepreneurs and businesses to protect those property rights and to protect their autonomy from either government encroachment or labor encroachment. That's deep in our history. And then when you combine it to see how management education in business schools, I teach in a business school, we teach about the need to respect worker rights, but that's not taught in most business schools anymore. And so there's now a whole generation or two of executives and managers who have no clue about their responsibilities toward workers with respect to worker voice. And so it's deep in the management culture of the United States. It's deep in our individualist and traditions for protecting property rights. And now it's embedded in the management culture of a new generation that never grew up with unions, never had to deal with them. And so we've got to address all of those. Now, it is a mistake to just explain the decline of unions on management resistance. It's a big force in the United States, but it's not the only force.
Let me come back with another question here. As you know, I know a lot of senior managers and executives in many American multinationals. What they would say to me is that, Tom, we respect workers' rights. We just don't need unions to make us respect them because we realize that respecting workers' rights is good for business. We don't need an outside agency to oblige us to do so. Maybe in the past we did, but not now.
There are some executives and some organizations that they lead that I think that rings true both in terms of what they say and what they do. The reality is that they are not the majority. They are among the more vocal managers, and they have led organizations in ways that reduce the incentive for workers to organize. But then there's another large block of American managers who might even say what you just said and espouse those things, but they don't put it in practice. So let's look, for example, at the most recent case and the most visible case of Amazon. Amazon is, as we all know, a gigantic employer. It's now the second largest private employer in the United States. Walmart is the largest. But if you look at either Amazon or Walmart, they will say exactly what you said. But they won't go to the step of then putting it into practice at the front lines of the workforce. They will take care of their executives that way, and they will take care of who they see as the, quote, talented professionals. But when it comes down to the front line, that's where they suppress worker rights. And that's reality.
You mentioned Amazon. Again, as you know, I know people in Amazon, and they would say what I said a few moments ago, and they would go further and say that, you know, despite some of what you read in the newspapers, we do treat workers on the front line with respect and dignity. And when it came to the vote in Alabama, Tom, it wasn't even close. Wasn't even close.
That's right. And we're still trying to understand all of the dynamics there. But when an employer in the United States, like Amazon, with enormous resources, is determined to defeat a union organizing drive, it can bring in the resources. It can hold private meetings called captive audience meetings and say, Tom, we are against unions and we recommend you not join the union because you'll just have to pay dues to these corrupt characters and you won't get anything in return. And by the way, there's no guarantee that the conditions you have today won't get worse because we have no obligation. They can't say we'll close the place because that's illegal. They can't make those client claims. But then they can do everything like, for example, put that message that we don't believe you should join the union, even post it in the bathroom stalls. Now, if there's any kind of a greater insult on human dignity than having to read an employer's claims how good they are in the most private moments of one's day, I don't know what it is. That's what's wrong with American management practice today. And that's why I believe at the highest levels of Amazon, they are committed to having a good workplace, and they treat their managers, their executives, their professionals quite well. And they tell their warehouse and terminal managers and so on, do the same thing, but then they don't provide them the resources. They don't provide them the ability to engage employees independently. They don't provide the staffing numbers. They have all the technology that controls and monitors people at the workplace. They are a organization that I know quite well, and they are an organization that is fixated on managerial control of the work process because that's their business model and it's worked very well for them. So they have blind spots and they say, gee, we've done all of these things. Why do they need a union? Well, it's not their decision under our law. It should be the workers' decision. And if workers feel that they've been treated well enough and they don't need a union, then they should act that way, but not have such a strong managerial campaign that puts them in a position that says these managers are going to make it miserable if we join a union.
I think you were going to say a couple of minutes ago before we went down this particular road that it's, how do I put it? You know, it's a supply and demand side when it comes to unionization. And if it's not just managerial opposition that has hindered the growth of unions. I think, as I suspect you were going to say, is that the unions haven't got their act together either.
Well, unions are following an organizing model that also doesn't work. And it was, again, on display at this organizing effort in Alabama with Amazon. It's very, very difficult to organize if you have to get 50% of one's peers plus one vote to get one new union member. That's what our law requires. Mm-hmm. And that might have worked in the 1930s and 40s when workers were out there already on strike and organizing in mass, and management said, gee, we better recognize them because that's the only way we'll get labor peace. But now, to try to organize, to get that campaign in the face of managerial resistance is very, very, very difficult. Unions need to open up their organizing to say, let's organize individuals. Let's take individual membership and then let's demonstrate the value that we can add by giving them voice and engaging employers and doing the best we can and building up to a majority status and providing new forms of participation and representation on safety and health committees, providing resources and technical expertise, giving them a series of benefits that might flow from union representation, and saying we also want a voice not just on wages, hours, and working conditions, but we want to work with the employer to try to improve productivity and quality and safety and make these jobs more meaningful, and be getting ready for changes in technology that are coming and making sure we provide the training. Those are the issues workers care about today. And those are the things that the labor movement has to learn how to deliver in order to attract the modern workforce. And that's not happening enough yet. Some unions are starting to do that. Many advocacy groups outside of the formal labor movement are raising these voice issues and these concerns, but they don't have a structure yet to make it sustainable.
The last time, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the last time these issues were looked at in depth in the United States was back in the days of John Dunlop and the famous Dunlop Commission. I think you were a member of that, if memory serves me right. And it was the labor movement which, in the end of the day, prevented anything worthwhile coming out of the Dunlop Commission, because they saw the sort of ideas that were being discussed as inimical to the model you've just been talking about. Do you, looking back, and by the way, I know that the chair, John Dunlop, was, how do I put this delicately, could be a difficult man to deal with. But looking back, do you see that as a lost opportunity?
It was clearly a lost opportunity, but it was a lost opportunity in setting up the Dunlop Commission.
Oh, talk to me about that.
President Clinton, when Bill Clinton was campaigning for presidency, he laid out a set of economic and workforce reform principles that I supported very strongly. That is, workers should have a voice at work. We've got to really build more cooperative processes at the workplace to generate more productivity, which will help us then to generate better jobs and so on. And so the day that he was elected and his Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, asked me to write a memo saying, lay out these principles. We met and we agreed that these are the principles we should follow. And I said, because there was already discussion, should we set up some blue ribbon commission? And I said, don't set up a commission, because there's no deal possible between business and labor on this. Lay out these principles, say this is what's going to guide our policies, and then ask business and labor to say, help us implement these. Instead of that, for whatever political reasons, the labor movement wanted a commission, the Clinton administration backed off of those principles and said, okay, we'll set up this commission and we'll create it with labor and business participation, and we'll put John Dunlop as chair. Now, John Dunlop was a very difficult person. He was one of the most brilliant people I've ever dealt with, one of the most difficult people. And we had a debate for about 15 years prior to that about whether the world of work was changing. And John was saying, oh, there's not really that much change. It's all cyclical, and you're overstating the changes. So we had to reconcile our differences on that commission. In the end, I always had great respect for him. And I think it was mutual respect and a real friendship when we got done, but we couldn't get anywhere. And we wasted 2 years of time where there was a window of political opportunity, because the Democrats controlled the Congress and the White House, to bring about real reforms. Instead, by the time we wrote some watered down report about what needed to change, the Newt Gingrich revolution took control of the Congress and all opportunity was lost. That was a terrible missed opportunity. But we've had another one. The Obama administration, even though it was a Republican-controlled Congress at least in the Senate, when President Obama was elected in 2008, I thought there was another window that maybe we could make change, because it was such a deep economic crisis. But that never happened there either. So we have to recognize that it's very difficult to pass labor legislation. And we have to take advantage of these windows of opportunity when they occur, and not believe that somehow we can get people in a back room and negotiate out between business and labor some agreement. Those days are over. We've got to take our issue to the American public, and they've got to call for change.
So that takes us neatly to President Biden. I know, you know, he's been around as long as you and I have. And he's been clearly a union man all his life, and he makes no secret of it. I'm never too sure with President Biden whether he's prouder to be a union man or an Irish man, but I'll go with the Irish guy bit. I'll go with the Irish guy bit for obvious reasons. So he's recently set up a task force to look at this question of unionization. And do you see that as being one of those windows of opportunity?
Well, I think President Biden is a very strong supporter of worker rights, of unions. He has made a statement to that effect about a month or 2 months ago now, before the Amazon election. And so the task force that he set up is a good step in the right direction. It's primarily internal to the administration, which means they have to work on what they can do through regulations, not try to get legislation. There is legislation in the Congress that they support, but this is trying to go a little bit beyond that. So they will do some things to strengthen unions and labor management cooperation among federal government employees so that they can demonstrate that, look, we're going to put into practice the principles that we preach and try to build good labor management relations back into the federal sector. They will do some things to coordinate efforts to strengthen regulations wherever they can in terms of purchasing power through contracting and so on, to put provisions in that perhaps require neutrality on union organizing, or maybe give preference to companies that provide good wages and working conditions and don't violate the law. That much they can do. Now, can they go beyond that? Not easily, because there's a limit to what they can do. But I think it's a symbolic important step, and substantively they will do some things that I think will move the needle in a more positive direction. But in the end, we've got to open up our labor law to more fundamental change. We got to build the case to the public for that.
Okay. So if President Biden or Marty Walsh, the new Secretary for Labor, came along to you today, Tom, and said, hey, you know, Tom, back in the day of President Clinton, you wrote the Statement of Principles. Could you rewrite that for us now? What would you put out there? What would you see as the fundamental principles of change that, you know, and if they said to you, and by the way, you can only nominate five, you know, let's prioritize here. What would you go for? Would you go for new forms of representation? Would you seek to see whether works councils are transposable to the United States? What would you look at?
So, Tom, you don't want me to be the typical academic and say there's 12 things. I agree with you. I won't do that. I won't do that. There are basically three things that I would urge. Number one, fix the basics of the law that makes it possible for employers to dominate and suppress union organizing under the current law. That's a necessary step, but it's not sufficient. But it's so clear. We said that in the Dunlop Commission in 1994 that law was broken, and here's the evidence. The evidence has become even clearer since then. So we've got to fix that so that workers really do have the basic right to organize under collective bargaining if that's what they want. That's number one. Number two, then let's open up this law to a variety of new forms of representation. And we don't know if works councils will work well in the United States, or whether board representation will work well, or under what conditions it might work well. But let's open up the law to allow those forms to occur. Let's authorize the Secretary of Labor to experiment with new forms, maybe even authorize states to experiment if the Secretary can be assured that they meet the minimum conditions. They're not going to make things worse, but they can build beyond it. And let's allow these new forms to emerge and to grow if they, in fact, meet workers' needs and and serve companies well. And number three, we've got to expand the law to protect people who are now excluded, the independent contractors, those people who work in, let's say, a McDonald's restaurant, but it's a franchise that McDonald's says, we're not the owners, we're not the employers, that's a franchise, that's independent. We've got to make sure that those workers, domestic workers, farm workers, contractors, franchise workers, are also covered under the law, but allowed to evolve in new ways. And so fix the basics, open it up for experimentation under some conditions so that it doesn't erode the law, but it allows new forms to emerge, see how they go, and expand coverage so that all people who work have some access to voice in their workplace.
So would you see something, Tom, like the Fight for 15 as being one of those new forms of representation? Because it seems to me that the Fight for 15 is not classic collective bargaining as we've understood it. What it seeks to do is to apply both social and political pressure to employers to raise wages. So is that an avenue that you could see people going down?
It really is the first step. Yes, it's raising awareness. It's putting pressure on low-wage industries like restaurants and warehouses, for that matter, to increase their wage to $15 an hour. But it's not building sustainable, ongoing organizations. And so I think we have to have more of those kinds of social movements, political movements that raise people's expectations, that get companies to respond because they can see the pressure building. And we have to then ask, how do we translate those into ongoing processes? And this would be another area where experimentation could play a key role. Lots of debate right now in the United States, at least among the academics and social activists, that we should have sectoral bargaining, that is, industry-wide bargaining. Well, that's a nice dream, but how we get there, nobody knows. Mm-hmm. But if we allow for different forms of consultation, engagement, discussion, wage boards, perhaps at the industry level, particularly for low wage workers, like restaurant workers and clothing stores and others, then you can find in some states where they do create some sectoral bodies that set wage standards and standards on safety and health and other things. But that's going to have to evolve. And that's why opening the law up to allow for these, and then let some of the more progressive states move forward and test these ideas and demonstrate their value, or that maybe they don't work so well in the United States, would be a real way forward. And that would encourage innovation in the labor movement. It would encourage innovation among immigrant groups, ethnic groups, women, minorities, all kinds of groups would be become much more active in helping to test those ideas. And I think we would get much more worker voice spread across the American workforce than we have, than we would ever get by just reforming the National Labor Relations Act in marginal ways and staying with the same organizing and representation model that we have today.
So one last comment, stroke question. I mean, I hear what you're saying about experimentation and so on. And of course, we also see the effects of social media on all of these things and the ability of people to communicate with one another in new ways. But isn't what you're talking about, doesn't what you're talking about require a sustained period of democratic administration in the United States? Because otherwise, you know, if they were to be returned to a Republican administration, the dial gets just changed back.
Well, it requires the American public to be determined that this is the direction for the future, and that they then pick the candidates that are most responsive to what they want. And if the Democrats want to stay in power for a long period of time, beyond even the 2 years to the next congressional elections, or the 4 years to the next presidential election, then they will get on board with this. Because this is where the American public, this is where the majority of the workforce says it wants to go. It hasn't heard enough about opportunities for going in that direction. But I think they're ready to be supportive if there's a political party and an agenda that responds to what they're asking. Now, yes, if we don't get legislation, then anything that's done by executive power can be overturned by the next administration. And that's why it's so critical to try to move forward now with legislation, or at some point, not in the not too distant future.
Okay, Tom, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I suspect we're at a point in American labor relations where there's a lot to play for. That there's, as you put it, there's a window of opportunity with the Biden administration. Whether that window will be opened and, you know, new ideas will come through that window, we wait to see. So now, let me let you get back to the wilderness in reality, you know, and not just with the picture. And can I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today? It's been a pleasure.
Tom, it's been wonderful to talk with you about these issues. It's so important. And I think these are issues that are important in the United States. But as you know, in your part of the world, there's also debates about these issues, particularly around building a new social contract. And I think the business community in Europe is more ready for that kind of discussion. And I'm hopeful that we will continue it, and you will continue to lead the way in voicing these ideas.
Well, let me say, and you'll soon, as you said to us at the start, be an emeritus professor, which probably means that you might have the time on your hands to come over and join us in person in Europe at some point when we're able to get back and do that, and for us to continue this debate, perhaps over a glass of wine somewhere or other.
I would love that. I would love, okay. I love the debate and the glass of wine.
Appreciate it. Tom, thank you so much.
Good. And thank you, Tom.
And to all of you watching, we'll see you again on our next Berg Bite. Good evening.